Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell. Russ Chinelli's in the studio today. And also, we've got a very special guest. He's dressed up like an admiral. He is an admiral. His name is Brett Jowar. That's correct.
That is correct.
Pronounce your name?
Yes, it is.
From Acadia, or somewhere down there near New Orleans, right?
That's right. Originally grew up outside of New Orleans. That's right.
And anyway, Brett Jowar is an admiral in the U.S. Public Health Service, not the Navy. So I got that wrong when I first saw the name Admiral. And he's also the senior advisor to the Secretary for Opioid Policy, Assistant Secretary for Health, all part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. That is a lot of an introduction, much more than I usually do, but welcome to Science Studio.
It is great to be here. Really looking forward to talking to you.
We're looking forward to it also. Before we get into what your role is in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, we need to know a little bit about Brett.
Okay.
How on earth did you go from, and I know you studied biology as an undergraduate student, and now you have this position. How did that transition work? Where did you make decisions to study biology, to go for an MD, to join this organization?
It's really quite a long story. I grew up in a small town in Louisiana, and like many people, I'm sure, and I've learned many people here, I was a first-generation college student. I mean, my father dropped out in fifth grade. He worked in the oil field. My mom was a police officer. She's still alive as a retired police officer. But they always valued education and made sure that I was sort of on the right track. And although I lived in a small town, I went to a high school in New Orleans, and it was a Jesuit high school there. And it was quite a trip because it was a couple hours each way with a bunch of buses and a ferry to get across the river. But it really opened my eyes to science and also liberal arts and creativity and history. And I really got interested in science just from a biology class in high school. And it's still a question that was pretty simple then, but it turned out to be really profound later on. And that is, why do people get sick when they're infected? I mean, it's a very simple question. You have an infection, but why does that mean you get sick? What are really
and why other people don't get sick?
And why other people don't get sick? But it really was a driving question to me about, and it led into all kinds of questions evolutionarily, biologically, medically, about how our systems and our defense systems are geared in a time when we didn't have antibiotics or hospitals. So it really, to some degree. Once you get infected, it's an all-out fight. It's either the bugs or you,
yeah.
and you're really geared that way. And that was really very interesting to me. And I went to college, I think, quite by accident. We didn't have much college counseling, even at Jesuit High School. But I was a debater in high school, and I was at a tournament in Cambridge at Harvard. And they were really interested in me in coming to debate there, which I didn't really want to do, but they had me fill out an application. I filled out an application, and
Rest is history.
The rest
then
is history.
Then you got into Harvard, right.
And we had lots of great opportunities there, again, that really opened my eyes, because some of really incredible people in biology, when Jim Watson teaches you molecular biology, and E.O. Wilson teaches you evolutionary biology.
You pay attention. Right.
And then medicine, to me, again, I didn't know much about medicine because we didn't have the history in my family, but I knew I was very involved. I was very interested in science, and someone who turned out to be my best friend was the valedictorian at Bronx High School of Science. So I didn't know very much, but I figured if I did what he did, I would probably be okay. So I tried to do what he did as much as possible.
And then after your undergraduate, let's go back before that. In your undergraduate curriculum, did you get into the possibility of doing some research?
I did.
That not available then?
That was very exciting for me. It was, you could officially do research and write an undergraduate thesis, but getting the foot in the door was a little hard. My roommate and I, because we were both fascinated with immunology, going back to why do people get sick, we kept going to Harvard Medical School to try to get a lab job, and particularly it was at the Enders building at Children's, and we tried to go in the front door, and no one would ever let us in because you're undergraduates, you don't have a degree, what are you doing here? So we snuck in the back elevator where the mice were brought up. We punched the button to the immunology floor, which was the 11th floor. We got out, walked in the first office, and said, we'd really like to learn and work. And The professor who was there said, I don't really know who you are, but, you know, we have lab space between 8 o'clock at night and 8 in the morning. Would you like to come? And we said, absolutely. So we spent 3 years doing some immunology work on autoimmunity. And
did you get a paper out of that? Did you publish any results?
My roommate and I had 3 first-authored papers that we alternated back and forth from Journal of Immunology.
As
undergraduates. We wrote them on typewriters, the whole thing. We also had the opportunity, which was an incredible opportunity to go as undergraduates, particularly at that time, to the clinic building. So we were doing work on autoimmunity, and we got to go see once a week children with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis and lupus, and really understood. And what was really motivating for me is, you know, the concept, which I hope we never lose, the bench to bedside kind of concept of trying to understand problems from a clinical point of view and bring them back to the bench, but also understanding the science at the very fundamental level and trying to bring them to the benefit of your patient. And that really was sort of a dominant influence in my life, that concept of, you know, trying to be a physician scientist that would be rooted in the best science, but to bring that for the benefit of your patient.
So let's get to that then, because after Harvard, you went to this famous University of Texas Southwestern for your MD degree. Well, that was an MD, pure and simple. You didn't do any research in that particular
So program. I did lots of research, but I didn't go to an MD-PhD program because I think, you know, I'd been in school a long time. I already had 4 years more education than anybody in my family. And the thought of doing 7 years till I got a real job was a little bit, it was a little bit daunting to me.
Right.
So I went to Southwestern consistent with what I just told you because I thought it was a place of real high science. And it clearly was. But also, Parkland Hospital is one of the world's most famous safety net hospitals that takes care of everyone, no matter whether they have money, what you look like, what you do, it doesn't matter. Everybody's valued and gets equal care. And I really wanted to be part of that. So I thought UT Southwestern, and I would say many medical schools in Texas, really still epitomize that. I think it's a great place to go to school. And so
Parkland
I went there.
Is a really, I mean, my own daughter had some treatment down there for seizures. But to get into that special research area, you had to go in through the emergency room.
Right.
And so you get to see within 4 floors, you know, the two ends of medical treatment in North America. And it's just absolutely amazing.
Absolutely. But I started doing research as a medical student in the summers and in spare time in labs because I really didn't want to lose that piece because you could really lose that during multiple years of training. And then I did a pediatrics residency and then a critical care fellowship. So I did 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, then 7 years of training afterwards.
Did you realize when you said that you cut short, you know, I don't want to be in this program, MD-PhD, for 7 years. I want to get out after 4 and get a real job.
Right.
Nobody told you about the other 7 years.
Yeah. But, you know, when you're a resident and a fellow, you're in the hospital doing what you really want to do. And it was very exciting. But I got together with a investigator there named Bruce Beutler, who had been on the groundbreaking end of discovery of one of the first cytokines called TNF. And while I was there, we did a lot of work on understanding the fundamental nature of the immune response that leads to someone getting sick during infections. And of course, he won the Nobel Prize for that in 2011. So it was quite fortuitous.
Look, you've got this tremendous background, highly educated, research, clinical treatment, pediatrician. And now you've suddenly become what you are, that is an admiral in the U.S. Public Health Service. That is a transition that a lot of the listeners are going to think, well, what happened there?
So let me tell you how this sort of happened in short form, and then I'll tell you what it means. So I was working very closely on a disease outbreak in the mid-1990s in North Texas. People are generally vaccinated for it now, but it wasn't required, the colic meningitis, the meningococcal disease. So we had the worst outbreak in North Texas of any place in the United States since the 1940s. So instead of seeing 1 or 2 patients a year, I was seeing 25 to 30 fulminant cases in the ICU every year and doing highly experimental treatment from the lab in there because a lot of these children had awful outcomes, amputations, death within 24 hours. After some of that work got a little bit of national notoriety, and it was on a front line for PBS, the Defense Department called me. And I didn't know about an agency called DARPA. I should know about DARPA, particularly material science. But they said they were very interested in the threats of biological weapons. And we don't have a lot of expertise in that. You're doing all this work. Would you come be on an academic advisory group? And I said, I don't really know who you are, what you do, but be happy to do that if I can serve my country by helping understand about emerging infectious diseases. And then it got progressively much more involved in biology at the national level. And then at 2004, DARPA is an interesting place because it's really true what they say. If you don't invent the internet, you get a B, right? And that's kind of the standards there. But you could only be there for 4 to 5 years. And I got invited to go in as the deputy director of the science office. And then I became director of the science office. And we did mostly material science in chemistry and physics. And
can you give us an example of the material science you did?
Well, we did a lot of very practical things, like creating new composites for armor systems that would be lightweight, multifunctional materials, self-healing materials. We did a lot of materials to defeat threats, but we did it at the fundamental level of materials. So how do you, sort of the new stealth? Can't go into what things we're trying to defeat, but how do you create materials?
How do you coat this with that so that it works?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And how could you fly it at Mach 5 and it not burn up, right? So, but we did a lot of biology too. And for example, we had a huge problem back then with people surviving in Iraq because of body armor, but coming back with no arms and no legs. So we really did the first modernized prosthetic. So the brain-controlled, fully functional prosthetic arm. We took that opportunity to do that because it was such a need for our returning young men and women.
I mean, that's an illustration of how the military have, in fact, helped guide medical practice and medical discovery that comes out to the rest of society. I mean, there wouldn't have been much of a demand for that because of a small number of people.
Well, the trauma system in Vietnam, the only reason we know about acute respiratory distress syndrome is because people survived their trauma long enough to have some lung injury, which we've now figured out how to fix that. But anyway, so I was there, and then I went back into academia, and I was really interested in engineering and academia. But the bottom line is I always wanted to go back to government in a public health role. And the Assistant Secretary for Health is the really chief public health person for the country. And it was a tremendous opportunity. And I am an admiral, but I am an admiral in the U.S. Public Health Service Commission Corps. If you've heard of the Surgeon General of the United States, the Surgeon General wears a uniform, is in the Commission Corps. We date back to 1798. There's 6,500 of us. We're all health professionals.
How many admirals?
Four-star admirals, there's one.
One.
And that's you. Me.
We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be straight back to talk about what are Admiral Jawar's current interests. Welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell with Admiral Brett Jawar from the United States Public Health Service. He's the Assistant Secretary for Health. Tell us, what are the big issues now that you're facing with as this senior person that's looking at the health of the United States?
Well, there are so many issues from vaccine policy to infectious diseases, but one of my main focuses that Secretary Azar, my boss, gave me is to lead the U.S. public health efforts against the opioid crisis. And when I say opioid, it's primarily opioid, but it's methamphetamine, it's increasing cocaine and other drugs of abuse. Our last data showed that 72,000 Americans died of overdoses in 2017, 72,000.
From the sum total of this
just in 1 year, and the great majority of those were from opioids. We started down this pathway by overprescribing medications like OxyContin when you really needed one or two and you got 30 days or 60 days. No one appreciated the addictive powers. People became dependent and addicted on that. When they became too expensive, they turned to heroin, which was very plentiful and cheap, primarily from Mexico coming up. And now we're in the third wave of this where where on the streets are very highly potent and very deadly synthetic forms of opioids. The most important one is called fentanyl, and that's primarily manufactured in China and shipped here either in the mail or shipped across borders and smuggled across. But my job is really to turn this around.
What in your body causes addiction?
So there may be certain propensities, but these chemicals, they bind to very specific receptors in your nervous system and particularly in your brain, because you have compounds that bind to them normally. You know, when you get a high from running or these are endogenous opioids that are there. Now, we pharmaceutically have gotten to those receptors, and they can be very important for pain control, but they also create a very powerful addictive quality where you become dependent on them. If you don't have them, you can't experience any happiness, you can't experience any joy. It causes long-term changes in the brain chemistry and actually some structural things, so that it really turns into, in early use, turns into a chronic disease, which is very hard to get over. So once you are addicted, once you have opioid use disorder, of which 2.1 million people in the U.S. have, it requires very intensive treatment or you're likely to die.
So you've been given this brief.
Yes.
You just woke up one morning and you said there's a note here, and now, Brett, this is what you're going to do for the next near future. It's such a big problem because you've outlined it. Illegal materials coming in, legal materials coming in, prescription over far more than is needed.
Right.
Where do you start on something like that?
Well, I think you start with common sense, and I think that's probably—
That's in short supply all around.
It is in short supply. So I think you start with common sense, with a little modeling, and— common sense says there's no silver bullet to end this. This is going to have to be a comprehensive all-of-society effort. And a couple things that are important, probably the most important thing, is for people to realize that addiction is a disease, and this is a public health issue, and you can't arrest your way out of this crisis.
Has that not yet been sort of understood?
I think it is pretty well understood now, but even a year ago, certainly 2 years ago, that transition was just taking place. And I think even certain state policies, even though we think it's a public health issue, there's still a lot of misinterpretation of what's a public health measure versus a non-public health measure. So I think you start with that. And then it's really about handling all facets of the problem. Number one, trying to prevent people from starting. Because once you're addicted, it's very difficult to get off, and that starts with dropping prescription opioids.
Well, and that's an interesting point right there. Is there a move to actually make sure that prescriptions only last for a certain period of time?
So,
I mean, that seems to be one point of
attack. Yes, and there's controversy about that. We've done it really by education of both the public and the medical professional. So the amount of opioids prescribed between January 2017 and January 2019 in the U.S. is down 28%. And in general, that's been done not by legal restrictions, but by education and understanding the problems. I get very worried about legal prescriptions because people who may have cancer pain or people who have other pain who may need long-term things could get denied. And I don't think we need to have the government in between a doctor or a nurse and the patient. But also, if we're too aggressive about doing that without coupling treatment, if we cut off the legal opioid supply, people are going to go to heroin and fentanyl. It's like telling you don't breathe for 10 minutes. You can't do it. People with the disease cannot stop. So if we're too aggressive, we can cause more deaths. So this has to be a really balanced approach. Peer coaching, I'll put that in general is there's three real legs of treatment. Number one, is there are medications to help you get over this. Number two, you need psychobehavioral support and counseling. And number three, you need the wraparound recovery services like, you know, faith-based organizations like jobs, employment, education, housing, peers that can help you reintegrate into society. Each one of those works to a degree, but you got to have all three of them to really get the best benefit. So people like that are invaluable. And one of my jobs as part of this is trying to make sure that the system can reimburse treatment so people like that can get paid. You know, it's not just a doctor writing a prescription that needs to get paid, because we need counseling, we need peer recovery, we may need transportation, employment. So you're seeing a very rapid move to sort of a holistic approach to this, where all these services can be paid for. So I spend a lot of time on that.
And that, of course, brings up the whole cost issue. I mean, the more people you have involved in the chain to help the person that's addicted, the more expensive it becomes. And that's something that I'm sure right now the whole country is having to think about into the future.
It does, and it's a very good point. And it's sometimes difficult to see past a year, particularly in Washington. But we have to understand that there are certain things that have an upfront cost, but that save tens, hundreds of billions of dollars.
Absolutely.
Moving forward. And if you have to look at all of society costs. So the Council of Economic Advisors for the President estimated that the cost to our society in 2016 of opioid use was $503 billion. That's healthcare.
That's plus $500 billion.
Plus lost productivity. And of course, everybody's dying at age 25, 28. Yeah. So spending a little money, and I don't mean a little money, I mean these are billions of dollars a year, but to get ahead of this will save enormous amounts of money, but you have to spend it up front, and sometimes that's tough. The good thing, and I'm going to say for all the dysfunction people see about Washington on TV, things like opioids and drug use, there's probably 98% agreement. So there's been really unprecedented money being allocated towards this in both sides of the aisle. Democrats, Republicans, Independents kind of really have a huge area of agreement on that.
There's probably still everybody up there knows people in their family or another family where it's an issue.
Let me give you two examples. The CDC director, Dr. Bob Redfield's son, unbeknownst to him, became addicted to cocaine. And like many the drug supplies, it was contaminated with fentanyl, and he almost died of an overdose. The Surgeon General of the United States, Vice Admiral Jerome Adams, he is the Surgeon General of the United States. His brother is incarcerated for drug addiction and stealing and criminal behavior. Wow. You can't see more of a contrast than that.
Yeah.
So literally, I think this crisis has touched nearly everyone in our society. You're only one person removed from knowing someone who's suffered.
So, I mean, the outcome of that brief conversation is that you're looking quite bullish on the fact that the country is going to come to grips and provide the resources.
I think the country's going to provide the resources, and there's lots of data, because we try to be data-driven, that we're moving at the right direction, but there are threats all the time. I mean, things could go bad very quickly in unexpected ways and in unexpected places. So although we are starting to move in the right direction with better outcomes, more people into treatment, it's a very fragile victory right now. And it's a very fragile, very partial victory.
So that was one of your briefs. The other one that you're sort of really involved with is vaccination. That's such
sure.
an urgent issue right now.
Vaccinations.
Well, yeah. How do you get around the fact that so many people, for so many reasons, find vaccinating their children, and you're a pediatrician, to be inappropriate?
Yeah.
How do you get around that?
Well, you know, it is a major topic of what we think about today, because we've become complacent because, you know, thousands of children aren't dying every year of polio or being put in iron lungs. But again, that's very fleeting, and we see now that there are measles outbreaks.
You know, you just said the word iron lung, and I'm thinking people under 40 probably don't even know what an iron lung was. I grew up in Britain, and this was a big issue, polio and then the iron lung.
Absolutely.
And so we've come tremendously far.
You couldn't breathe,
right.
And so you had to be in these very primitive ventilators all lined up, and people were paralyzed. And vaccines are really one of the triumphs of modern medicine, of public health. Tens of millions of people died worldwide before vaccines. I think the latest estimate was, since the introduction of the measles vaccine, we've saved an estimated 23 million lives from measles worldwide just by the vaccination. So I'm going to say that there's some people who really just will never be convinced to vaccinate their children, but there's a large amount of people who really just get misinformation. And I will tell you, you want to talk about Russian interference, there is clear Russian trolls and bots who are spreading misinformation about vaccines. We know this very clearly, just to cause societal discontent within the United States. And they're doing it in other countries, too. So a lot of the information you see is meant for nefarious purposes.
I just want to come back to one final issue, then, of the vaccination, because you just said it, 23 million people being killed by measles.
Right. Right. If it wouldn't be for the vaccine.
Right. And then you will see people who will say, well, but a certain number of the people who take the vaccine get sick, maybe even die for all I know. I don't know that. But it's such a small number. These are the numbers that need to be out there from the official documentation that you're in charge of, I guess.
Yes, we are. And we are working very hard on getting the right messages out. It's really, I think, if parents had the right information, the right scientific information, and we're seeing this, that even places where vaccination was very low, now that measles is coming back and the information's getting there, they're getting on board.
As an MD, as a pediatrician,
yes.
What do you do with small groups? Because there are parts of this country where, for whatever reason, a large number of people don't vaccinate their children. And so there's an outbreak. What do you do to quarantine that outbreak? Can you?
Well, this is really up to local areas. I mean, there are areas in New York just this last week that basically said that if you're not vaccinated, you can't go to public places because right. of the risks of spreading. So these are local and community decisions about quarantine. These tends to be done by state levels or community levels. But your point is there are pockets, and many of those are demographic or cultural pockets, and we have to do a better job understanding how to reach people where they are.
What are you going to do in 10 years' time? Are you going to come back into medicine as a pediatrician? I mean, do you have a goal? Do you have a trajectory for the remaining years of your career?
It's hard to think past what I'm doing now because it is – it's pretty consuming and very important, and I feel completely satisfied, compelled, enriched. But, if you had to guess after this, I'd probably like to work at a nonprofit and really use all my experiences in medicine, but now with policy and government, to really work for some meaningful causes that can help people from that aspect. I bet that's where I'll wind up.
So you don't think you'll be having children coming into your clinic and with a cough and a cold?
I don't think so. I do like doing missionary humanitarian work, and I find that very rewarding. But as a day job, no.
Okay. Well, that's the way to finish. We now know the future for Brett Girouard, all right? It's going to be in a non-profit organization doing good things around the world. Thank you so much, Brett, for being here on Science Studio. It's been a lot of fun.
Been a pleasure being here. Thank you.